You're listening to TFM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
Hey, everyone. I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading in case I got bored.
Hello and welcome to Literary Treks, TFM's local books and comics show. I am just one of your hosts, Casey Pettit, and with me, as he always is, he is not my estranged father, but he is none other than Jonathan Cohn. Jonathan, how are you this fine evening?
I always like how you connect the connection of me to the book somehow. It's always so creative. I like it. I'm doing well. I was nervous going into this book and excited coming out of it. So I'm excited to talk about it.
Yeah, I'm excited too. Yeah, we're talking about Deny Thy Father, which is one of the Lost Era books. We've not had a great track record with some of the recent ones we've done. So yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to talking about it with you as well. But before we get into it, though, I want to tell our listeners how to find us. You can find us wherever you listen to podcasts, and especially if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please give us a star rating and a written review, as that will help others find our show. You can follow us on X and Instagram at TrekFM, on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM, and you can see all of the shows, current and past, if you just go to the website, trek.fm. And head on over to Goodreads, and you can join our group there. Or you can join in on the discussion on the Facebook group, the Babel Conference. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and it should come right up. And lastly, please consider supporting the network on Patreon. It takes a lot of money to produce these shows and to keep them available on the servers. Just head on over to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And select from any number of tiers there. If you're so inclined, you can be named as an associate producer on your show of choice, just as Greg Rozier and I are for Literary Treks. And your support would mean the world to us, so we can keep this show coming to you. Well, Jonathan, we don't really have any news this week. Unfortunately, no new book news or anything like that. So
we did get a book cover.
Well, okay, that's a good point. Yes, I forgot we did get a cover. Yes.
We got the cover right after I did a video asking where in the world is that cover. So I made that video, then we got the cover afterwards. So I was like, well, darn, I need to make another one.
Yep.
But I'm glad we got it. So we have covers for all the announced books, at least.
Yes, and there's only a few, so you know, it's nice to have that for sure. And that was, which one was that? Asylum by Una McCormick?
Yeah, that was Asylum by Una McCormick, which comes out in November. And then the other one that we know for sure is coming is the James Swallow book. That's also a Strange New Worlds book.
Yeah, I want to say it's
Fear... Fear No something.
Or I thought it was Towards the Night or something.
Towards the Night, you're right. Oh, Towards the Night. That was a different. Fearful Symmetry was the other one he did in the past.
Oh, that's right.
Towards the Night is the other one that comes out in early.
April-ish.
2025.
We'll keep the listeners posted on that one for sure. Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we head back into the Wayback Machine, back into the Lost Era, and see if we can find out what was going on between Will and Kyle Riker.
Or rather, what's not going on.
Well, Jonathan, we are on our second to last book of the Lost Era, which is Deny Thy Father, and has a nice little portrait of very young Will Riker on the cover. And so, you know, obviously we knew right away this was going to be a Riker book. But, you know, one of the things that is kind of cool about this book, too, is we get Kyle Riker, who is his estranged father that we saw on the TNG season 2 episode, The Icarus Factor. We knew that there from that episode, there was some animosity between them, that Kyle had a thing with Dr. Pulaski. And in that episode, Dr. Pulaski even talks about how Kyle was like the only survivor of a Tholian attack on a starbase. She didn't name it or anything, and we really didn't get much more than that. And, you know, we got to see a little bit of them kind of coming to terms with each other in that episode after not having spoken in 15 years. So interestingly enough, this book actually takes place about 8 years before that episode. So we know if it's going to follow canon that they can't be speaking or seeing each other or anything. So, you know, I guess to start with, was this like, I don't know if you rewatched the episode or if you've seen it recently or ever, but was this something that you were thinking you wanted a story about? You know, was this what you were even expecting with this book?
Well, if I've seen the episode, it was years ago and I don't remember as well. I had not realized that, you know, canon connection that they weren't allowed to show them in the same room or together at all because they hadn't seen each other in so long, because I felt like that was missing in the book. I was like, you're going to do this whole thing about the father and son Riker, and they're asking, Will, have you seen your father recently? We're looking for him, and there's all this going on. And you don't show them, like, I was thinking, at least at the end, there's going to be some kind of a something. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe, you know, they're in the same room and they, like, don't talk, but they're at least, they see each other or something. But that didn't show up. And so I just thought that was an odd choice. I still enjoyed the book, but I thought it was an odd choice. And then when you were doing that rundown, I was like, oh, that makes sense why the author wasn't allowed to include them together.
Yeah, and I rewatched the episode this afternoon, and so I didn't. It'd been years since I'd seen it either. So I was kind of feeling the same way as you. Like, really? We get to the end of the book and they're not going to confront each other or anything like that. And to find out that the author basically, I mean, from everything I could tell, fit this story pretty well within canon. And, mm-hmm. you know, he, you know, Kyle Riker was kind of in the background pulling some strings for Will. I mean, at least at the very end. You know, kind of as a strategist and everything, but, you know, Will didn't know that. And, you know, when you watch the episode that takes place like 8 years later after this, you can tell that Will has no idea that his father probably has been following his career. And so, yeah, mm-hmm. I thought it was kind of interesting, but really well done, in my opinion, how well the author kind of maintained what was given to us in the episode, kind of as the backstory or the forward story or whatever you want to call it.
And interestingly, their individual stories in this book don't have much overlap until the very, very end. But it actually, they work as good complements to each other. One of them is very much a political thriller. The other one is more of like a romance love triangle with also like kind of like a college storyline that's also got like also the traditional touchstones of Star Trek in there, the Academy. And so they're two very different storylines that if you had two of the same, it might have felt a little bit too much of one thing, but because they complimented and they were going back and forth, I thought that it paced the book really well. And I never felt either storyline got too much time. I felt they were, you know, very even.
Yeah, I agree. We've had a lot of Star Trek books and a few in the Lost era too, but just in general where there's kind of an A story and a B story. And, you know, we got this with the shows too, where, you know, sometimes the plots really don't connect, or you've got to really kind of squint mm-hmm. to see how, you know, how they kind of connect. But, you know, this is one where, yeah, it wasn't like, you know, when we talked to Greg Cox last time about his book, Lost to Eternity, where kind of each chapter kind of alternated between a different time period. We mm-hmm. almost had that here, not between time periods, but between like Kyle and Will's stories. But like, right. you know, every now and then you get a couple chapters in a row of Will or a couple chapters in Kyle. And I felt like it was, yeah, really well paced, where when it got to a chapter and, you know, and it was, you know, maybe it's the end of a Kyle chapter and it went right into another Kyle chapter, I was like, okay, good, because I want to follow this. You know, mm-hmm. I wasn't kind of almost like let down or anything because yeah. I wanted to keep going. But also at the same token, and when we get into a Will chapter, I was like, okay, I'm excited too, because I kind of want to see what's going on with him at the Academy. And so, you know, this author, Jeff Marriott, I don't think we ever really decided how to pronounce his name. So if he's listening, he can give us a pronunciation guide if he wants. But he did, I feel like he did a really good job of pacing the stories. They weren't working in tandem with each other, so they didn't need, because they didn't need to until, like I said, until you got to the very end where they do overlap somewhat, and in a very good way, I think, you know, a very apt way to really not just have two stories that they smash together and call it a book, you know, like it, mm-hmm. they made it make sense, like why Kyle was where he was, why Will was in the danger that he was in, why Kyle was the one that had to help, you know, solve those issues.
And the connective tissue between them is ironically not the fact that they're father and son, but to me, the connective tissue is Admiral Paris. Because he's the character that is in both stories, essentially. He kind of disappears from the Kyle one for a while, but he's the anchor of the Kyle story. And then he's also part of the anchor of the Will story. And he's a character that I wanted to talk about a little bit because, you know, he's very minor in Voyager. You see him a couple of times in Voyager. Like, he has a very distinct voice and characterization. And I think that they really made him kind of complex because he had this element of, you know, kind of brushing up against his son, Tom Paris. And then at the same time, you also had him having some really sweet moments with Tom, or having some really just like heartfelt moments with the whole Voyager crew. And so he was just a really fascinating character anyway in the show. And then the books have just given him so much more depth. And here, even though he sometimes has to get on to characters like Will for his shenanigans, or even though sometimes he like gets frustrated that Kyle just ups and disappears for a while, he still feels like the series' dad. Almost like he is like, I saw someone use this in Star Wars, and I don't know if it's ever been used to describe, a character in Star Trek, but, when you have an admiral who, feels like a father figure, they call him the Dadmiral.
Oh, yes.
And that's the term I would use for Paris, especially here, is like, even when he's having to like reprimand them, it still felt like he was having to reprimand his child because yeah. he was so connected with Kyle and so connected with Will. And his was the character I actually really liked in the book and was always excited when he popped up on the page.
Oh, that's a really good point. And just hearing you say that, it kind of makes me want more Admiral Paris stuff. And mm-hmm. maybe we'll get more in the next book, since the next one takes place just a few years later. But we would be so lucky. So we'll see. But yeah, I agree. I mean, like, I think a lot of the characters, at least the ones that show up often, I'm not talking about cameos or anything like that, mm-hmm. but just some of these main characters, including there was another Admiral too that showed up a couple times, not the yeah. one that ends up being kind of the bad guy, but there was another one anyways that was that I feel like it was one that we've seen before, and it was like kind of just well placed. And so yeah, I think that the author here did a good job. Like, that was a good use of a known character.
Mm-hmm.
He could have just as easily made an original character and it would have worked fine. Yes. But to use Admiral Paris there, and especially as that kind of father figure for Will, since he didn't really have one, mm-hmm. And also kind of knowing Tom Paris's relationship with his father, where they kind yep. of were a little bit, not so much estranged, but, you know, I know that, you know, Tom always felt like he was a disappointment to his father and things right. like that. And so seeing Admiral Paris kind of, not necessarily take Will under his wing, but kind of, you know, he was mm-hmm. he was kind of the the head of Starfleet Academy or whatever he was, you know, like, you know, as far as this, or the Starfleet representative for the Academy. I thought he was, you know, pretty well utilized here for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were so many moments where he's like, oh man, you screwed up, but it was awesome. Like he just like, he couldn't go outright say, oh man, that was so awesome, because he has to keep that composure. But he was thinking it, you know, he was thinking it.
Like after the fight in the fish market and the Vulcan Academy superintendent or whatever she was giving him a dressing down, and Paris talks to him afterwards and he's like, really, fish? Okay. I mean, like, did you get some good luck? You didn't even participate in the fight.
It was effective also to make the head of the Academy a Vulcan, because then it makes it even more like the serious demeanor.
Yeah.
This person's not going to understand the nuance of, or at least unless your name's Spock, you're not, as a Vulcan, you're probably not going to appreciate the nuance to Riker's side of the story from like the fish market or any of the other shenanigans he does.
Yeah. That was just like, you know, a fun aspect of the story, which, you know, didn't have huge implications, and I'm talking about Will Riker being at the Academy. You know, we get to see certain kind of a little snapshot of three different years of his years at the Academy, and you know, on this one where he gets in the fight in the fish market, well, his team gets in the fight with fish in a fish market in San Francisco. You know, it's this it's almost like a scavenger hunt around San Francisco that they're trying to do, and pretending as if they're on this unknown world and have their technology taken away. And there's another scene or whatever, or another piece where he's trying to get out of doing this flight, not even training, but kind of like test, just so he can go hear Spock speak at the Academy, and is kind of coming up with this whole scheme to trade places with somebody who couldn't care less about seeing Spock give a speech, but who would really want to go fly this mission. And then, you know, the real lesson from that was that, you know, Will kind of sees his kind of the error of his ways and trying to like skirt the issues and realizing that he needs to really kind of own his own career, I guess, you know, and do the right thing if he's going to be a Starfleet officer and stuff. So it was kind of fun seeing Will at this time of his life, something we've never really gotten to see before, even in those like, probably, I don't know if they're white, I'm sure they were actually more like middle grade books, you know, or something from the Starfleet Academy series, where you had like Worf and you could see, I think, Data in the Academy. And I think there was one about Geordi, but we never got like Will or Jean-Luc Picard or any of them. So like, but this is kind of a more grown up way of looking at it, I think.
Mm-hmm. The shenanigans that go on here felt very college-y.
Yeah.
Like I could see a movie that focuses on colleges telling this type of story. Obviously it was still very appropriate, which a lot of those college-y movies are not. But you could some of the shenanigans there. And it was interesting that, you know, the whole sending them to San Francisco and being like, all right, well, you're gonna pretend like you're on the planet, but you're not actually, you're really on like Earth and like the simulation type thing. It reminded me of a young Sheldon episode where he has to, you know, he has to go to a birthday party and he does not want to go, but he kind of has to. So he decides to pretend to be in Star Trek and just to treat it as if he's like Spock landing on Earth for the first time and being like, what is this, a chicken? And like walking around the party like that. It was funny because they're walking around San Francisco. It's like, y'all like live here. Like, this is, you don't, you know what all this is, but you have to pretend that you don't.
I know.
And so there was like a little bit of absurdism to the plot that I thought was, because I could totally see a college being like, look, we can't ship you out to like Neptune to see another planet at the moment. That'd be a lot of resources. So instead you're just going to have to make believe here.
Yeah. Well, and it was kind of a nice change of pace from the other stories going on too. You know, it was a little bit more light. We still have like him, you know, the kind of one of the later scenes at the Academy where his friend is kind of like falling behind and Will has kind of determined to do whatever's necessary to get like the highest grades he can, mm-hmm. to get the best posting that he can. And his friend comes to him and says, dude, I need you to tutor me, or I need you to help me cheat. And Will's like, well, first of all, I'm not going to help you cheat. So Star Trek points to you, Will. And then, you know, he says, as far as like tutoring you, I can tutor you on the stuff that I'm studying for myself because, you know, whatever, like I need to study those anyway, but anything that I'm not taking right now, you're going to have to find someone else. And this friend kind of flips out on him. Mm-hmm. And basically says, no, if you can't give it all, then I'm not going to give you anything. And I thought that was like kind of an interesting character moment for Will, because he was really struggling with this. Like, he was dead set, like, I'm not going to help this kid cheat. But like, he was kind of almost as stubborn as the friend, you know, like he wouldn't go talk to the friend, and I probably wouldn't either if I was him. But you can kind of see parts of future Will in that, where he's very career focused. You know, like on Next Generation, he was very much like, I need to be on the Enterprise. In fact, even in the episode, The Icarus Factor, that this is loosely, you know, kind of a prequel mm-hmm. to, I guess. That episode is where he's offered his first command and decides to turn it down because he feels like he's kind of on a better ship on the Enterprise. It's better to be second command on the flagship than first in command on some kind of unknown ship somewhere. And right. You kind of see that here, too, with him, like, really focusing on that part of his career.
I had thought when I was reading this that if there was one thing that I thought would have made this story, I think, a little bit more interesting, which is to change the love triangle to be between Dennis and I forgot her name. It was like Felicia and Will, and swap out, I forgot the name of the other character that was interested in Felicia with Dennis, because then it would have made the scene where they're arguing about, you know, how to help him and meet in the middle type thing. I felt like that would have been a little bit more dynamic, because then Felicia's not just trying to mediate and mediate between two friends, but also between two guys that are vying for her attention. It would have put the strain more with her relationship with Will. But since it's between Will, who she's in the romantic connection with, and then Dennis, who she has like no romantic connection with, it just didn't hit as hard there. But I thought that it was really interesting how you said both of them are stubborn, and it requires someone else to say, have y'all thought about like finding another way to do this? Like, right. you guys could meet in the middle. And I don't know if Jeff Marriott was going for this in his writing, but when they at the end, when they talk about the placements, and, you know, Riker got eighth and Dennis got like dead last in the class, it reminded me of how back in the Civil War era, you know, all these Union generals who were awful at their jobs were getting the highest ranked in their classes. And then you had George Pickett, who was from the South. He got dead last in his class. And yet he actually had some really good political and I mean strategic instincts. In fact, if Lee had listened to Pickett instead of his plans, you know, Gettysburg would have gone very differently. And so it's quite funny that, you know, just because you're not at the top of the class does not mean you have no value. Yeah. And I think that, you know, even Riker tries to explain that to Dennis, is that, look, you may have gotten the lowest in the class, but still, hey, I mean, like, that's a better calling card than getting in the middle of the class.
Right.
Dennis just doesn't seem to get it. And I feel like this is because in their society, they're always told to be the best, that just Dennis thinks that because he was the worst, that his value is just gone. And it was like, man, like, imagine just how valuable he could have been as an officer, someone who understands failure better than anyone, what he could have done. Maybe I wonder if Dennis would have been the best instructor at Starfleet Academy, because he understands what it's like to be the worst, and he would be good at building people up and getting them better and better. And
yeah,
I just,
That's a good point, because, I mean, one of the things about Star Trek is we see everybody working together, and, you know, rarely on the shows did we ever see somebody that's quote-unquote the worst at something. I mean, we saw Barclay, right. But even Barclay, they acknowledged, was like a genius, you know? Like,
right.
And, yeah, like, and that almost makes me wish that we got more of Dennis anyway, because you know, just to see, like, I mean, what, I mean, it kind of came, it felt like it came out of left field just because we kept getting these short snippets, mm-hmm. you know, from their years and their time at the Academy. But what we did get to see was competition throughout. Mm-hmm. And they even call it out at some point. You're kind of in competition with everyone else. But then at the end, like you said, like Will even points out to him, like, you graduated just the same, or yeah, you graduated just the same as the rest of us. Like, you're going to be an ensign, an officer, just like the rest of us. No one is ever going to know, except for you, where you ranked in the class, except mm-hmm. that, you know, like, of course, being eighth, you know, and I think even Captain Pressman says it when he gets on the Pegasus, like, oh, eighth in your class, not so bad, huh? You know, but like, right. but even still, like you said, like, you know, that those, I mean, quote unquote failures. Yeah. Like, especially, you know, they must have mounted pretty hard for Dennis, for him to end up feeling like that. And it makes me want to know more about him. Like, what else was going on in his life that he decided it's better to not be in Starfleet at all. And maybe it was just that, yeah, Will ruined it for him for some reason.
I also wonder what his home life was like.
Yeah.
Because I wonder if he had this, a parent with unrealistic expectations for him, and that just, you know, ruined any chance he had of being successful afterwards. Hmm. I'd be really curious.
Like a real successful captain or admiral or something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I mean, this is all kind of the B story.
Yeah, I know, right?
Of the book, because the A story is the political thriller.
Yeah.
Which I really liked. And it's also, it's not just a political thriller, but it's kind of like a mystery. Like in some political thrillers, you know exactly who the villain is and why they're angry or something. And then sometimes you really have no idea. And one that came to mind here for me was Eagle Eye, that 2008 movie, with Shia LaBeouf, because in that movie, you don't know who the villain is exactly at the beginning. But you know that they have some sort of power because, you know, they are connected with government and government agents are doing mm-hmm. this stuff and there's technology involved. And, you know, poor Kyle Riker, these guys come to arrest him and he's like, I didn't do anything wrong. And he was like, I almost died and y'all are still wanting to arrest me. And it just made me root for him even more, because it felt like everything, like the deck was stacked against him. And you also had the mystery of, you wanted to find out, why are they trying to kill Kyle? And so they did a good job of building up, making you like him, and then all of a sudden putting him in danger and making you sit on the edge of your seat.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, when we start with him, I mean, just getting the backstory of the Tholian attack that he survived, you know, mm-hmm. and putting it in a place, and kind of throughout the first several Kyle chapters, kind of living through his PTSD with him as we get to learn, like as he's remembering and we get to almost learn how this attack and took place. And in fact, I think they even kind of really just spell it out or almost show it to us later in the book. But so we get that. And then, yeah, this mystery where we've set up Kyle Riker to be a good guy. Like, we know that he's a target kind of for no particular reason or that we can mm-hmm. discern, you know, and to know that, like, Admiral Paris and, you know, some of the other folks that he talks to at Starfleet believe him, which mm-hmm. is good. But also that somebody in Starfleet, like, he knows that people in Starfleet uniforms are the ones that are attacking him and trying to kill him. And so it's just like, okay, yeah, like, well, we've got Starfleet backing him up, you know, kind of in secret. They're trying to keep the loop pretty small. But yeah, it was really interesting seeing, like, knowing that it had to be somebody in Starfleet, but then he also has to go to Starfleet to get help with this.
And it follows a lot of tropes. One of the tropes that is very common in thrillers is in Act One, your hero's being hunted. And by the end of Act One, the hero realizes they're not going to stop until he disappears. So he disappears. Act Two, the hero is now in this, like, really secluded area, and he's making connections with the locals, and he's, you know, finding life outside of the thriller environment. and then something happens there, an event that causes the hero to have to return to the fight. And then the third act is that about them returning and facing down the, I mean, like that is like that, that's, that is Thriller 101. And that is this book to a T. And it's, I use trope instead of cliche because it works here, you know, and all of the decisions for him to realize I got to run. And then him being so frustrated in the middle when his romantic connection dies, and then deciding to rejoin or just to go back and talk to Owen Paris and being like, all right, we gotta figure this out. All of that made sense for the character and made sense for the plot. And so it ended up being a trope and working well as opposed to a cliche.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people sometimes hear the word trope and think it's a bad thing when it really all it is a kind of outline, or, you know, it's an idea that can be taken many different ways, you know, to make, you know, you could have four or five books that use the same tropes, but still awesome. And I mean, I think as you're describing it, I'm thinking about this book and I'm like, yeah, man, like, yeah, that is used a lot, but I mean, because it works, like it was really effective here, because his time away was interesting and gave us, I mean, even more, I guess, ammunition might be the wrong word, but to like Kyle, to know that he's a hero. Because, I mean, especially from the episode that he appeared in of Next Generation, he wasn't really likable or unlikable. He was just kind of this, you know, it was obviously a Will Riker episode, but, you know, Kyle Riker comes in and we don't have enough information to like or dislike him. We have to dislike him because Will does, but we have to like him by the end because Will does. Here, we get to see, you know, with this time on this other planet, like he's trying to be this average Joe, like he has a job. He's living kind of in the slums really of this planet, but more because it's a way for him to like save up money, I guess, you know, and which he donates to charities anyway. But ends up kind of getting involved in a rebellion on that planet anyway, because he's a strategist and can kind of help there. And I don't know. It was just fun to see him, you know, as Will's trying to like figure out women. We've got Kyle kind of doing the same thing, which his first wife died, you know, Will's mother died. Then he was with Kate Pulaski. Now he's got this gal, Michelle, that he's with, who I have to say, I thought it was pretty stupid of her to use the name Kyle Riker as her kind of false name to use to give to the authorities or whatever. Cause I was like, that sucks. You just.
But it's like in Pirates of the Caribbean where she calls herself Will Turner.
Oh, right.
Or not Will Turner, but she says he's, yeah.
It's something it's Turner, like Elizabeth Turner. Turner,
and it's like, come on, man. Like, of all the names you could have picked, you picked the worst one for that group. She could have been Turner for, like, anyone else capturing her. Turner's great, great name. But because of that, it's like, like Michelle could have used Riker for anything.
Right. But yeah, like, and she's supposed to be kind of the one of the ones that's in charge of this thing. Like, she should have known better, but
yes,
it also led to him being able to kind of call himself out. But then we've got the nice, I am Spartacus moment. You know, just to get him to realize that, okay, I gotta get off this planet and go back home and fix my stuff and not die here before, you know, I figure anything else out. But it was, you know, I don't know. It was just a good part of the story because it kept moving. The characters that he interacted with were pretty well, you know, well drawn out so that you could kind of see what his life looked like for almost a year, for a little over a year, maybe, on this planet, while he's just basically biding his time.
Mm-hmm. And I really liked the conversation when he finally gets back with Owen Paris, and they're like, all right, we're going to make you a strategist. You're going to help us figure things out. And oh yeah, I forgot to mention that your son is involved in all this stuff. I love that conversation. And the big action sequence near the end with Will and with the Pegasus was so fascinating because I thought it was mostly, it felt like a kind of run of the mill, you know, type story for the most part. And then when they started planning, and they're laying the seeds for this, you know, this maneuver that's so crazy, but, you know, we kind of got to go with it because we don't have any other options, which was essentially to fake auto-destruct, or at least to play chicken with it, and to set the sequence and to go straight at the enemy ships and make them be like, nope, 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 we're getting out of here. Turn off the auto-destruct and then hyperspace out. For one, it was like, it felt like a callback to a couple of things. It felt like a callback to Search for Spock. But it also just felt like very much like something that you'd see in like Hunt for an October type, you know, naval thriller where, all right, we have no chance to win unless we do this really daring thing that is like, has like a 1% chance of victory. And I just thought that was a very clever way of weaving in the auto-destruct sequence and also establishing Will doing these crazy maneuvers in the TV show, because he's also he comes up with some crazy maneuvers in the TV show and some of the action sequences. And we see where he kind of gets that, ironically, from his father and from his leadership that he's listening to.
Yeah, like Will never gets to know, I guess, how much of his father is in himself.
Yeah.
But, you know, the fact that he even spoke up while they were trying to plan this out, like that he was behind this plan. Like he was only kind of on the Pegasus end of it, only in communication with Admiral Paris. Mm-hmm. Obviously Kyle Riker's in the room with Paris, but you know, and can hear what's going on the bridge of the Pegasus, but you know, Will doesn't know that. And that's where I felt like it was so clever. How Jeff Marriott set up this scene where mm-hmm. Kyle was there, aware of what's going on. Will was just a participant, you know, and didn't know that his father was there. He might not have been very happy if he knew his father was there. Since,
right, yeah.
You know, like even in the episode, he tells the story about like how there's this picture of him as a kid holding a fish. And I think it was Dr. Pulaski, or might have been Troy, I can't remember now, but you know, oh, is that a fish you caught? And he goes, no, my father caught it. It's like, well, the picture makes it look like you caught it. He goes, yeah, I hooked it, but then my father grabbed the rod from me and reeled it in himself because he thought that I might lose
that's
it.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and so like I think, you know, it almost would have been interesting to get some future scene here, like that's set during the episode, that's just like, oh, by the way, remember when you were like very first on the Pegasus, I was there, but that probably wouldn't go over so well. No.
That's getting into the tie-in fiction where you're working a little too hard to make things tie together. It's exactly. Like, hey, it doesn't need to be like, oh, you need to write a scene where it's like, Will, you remember that time on the Pegasus? Well, actually, I was behind the scenes on that. Really? What does that have to do with, you know, this episode?
The way that it turns out too with, you know, all the mind controller, it got a little convoluted, but you know, the mind control and the kind of dual personality are basically almost like a psychotic break, you know, from this admiral. But it was one of those things. It's, I mean, it was obviously the MacGuffin kind of for the story. It wasn't like this huge thing with big implications or anything like that. It was really just literally the MacGuffin for the story, but it also didn't, it didn't kind of come out of nowhere, I guess, you know, cause we got some little tidbits throughout the book of the father and son, or, you know, whoever it was, you know, talking to themselves and everything, but it wasn't one of those where it just was like a huge letdown, like, oh, that's all, you know, no deus ex machina or anything that came in, just be like, okay, everything's fine now. I felt like this was something that kind of worked and, you know, for this story too.
Now, I think it worked not only because it tied into the backstory from the show about the Tholian attack. So it worked on that end, but also it worked because the whole book is just layered with all of these conversations between the mind controlled guys or the mind influence guys that, you know, the one person is given the instructions and they're accepting it, but they're not able to carry it out. And you're already seeing the susceptibility that they have in all of those conversations that, like, if we went back and reread it knowing that, mm-hmm. I would think, oh, you probably would pick out more. It's kind of like an Agatha Christie mystery. When you go back and reread an Agatha Christie book, you'll be like, oh, I can see all these connections that I missed before.
Yeah.
Something connections that I noticed this time, but wasn't always happy. So the cameos, and you have this on the outline. Some of the cameos were great. Like Ben Sisko was a genius cameo.
Yep.
I thought that was great. I thought that was brilliant. And I thought, of course, Owen Paris worked really well. And I thought that Quinn from Thaddeus Riker's journals and like Thaddeus Riker, like going seeing, we got like what, basically one chapter that was the whole Thaddeus Riker story from the Civil War. Like that was really cool. But there was one in here, and I'm a nostalgia. I'm a throw me all your Easter eggs and cameos guy. Like I love that in my books. I love it. But there was one in here that I just thought, okay, that was a bridge too far. Like that was just literally you saying, you want a reference? I got a reference for you. And that was, maybe you'll agree with me, Ensign Janeway.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. When she stepped on the screen, I said, okay, that was just, that was ridiculous. Ensign Janeway does not need to be in this story. No. You already have the Voyager connection. You already have the DS9 connection. You already have the, like, you have the stuff. If Paris wasn't there and it was a, like an original Admiral, maybe it would have been warranted to throw in another Voyager character. But Ensign Janeway there, she exists to like bring something in and then bring it out and then leave like immediately after.
Yeah.
So her sole purpose is to be the cameo. And I was like, come on. That was...
Yeah. I mean, some of the cameos that they had, I mean, even like McCoy, I think, gave the speech at graduation, which is actually pretty good. And
yeah, I liked McCoy's speech.
I think Picard is name dropped at one point. Will sees Geordi on campus, but that's about as far as it goes. You know, like we just get a paragraph of him seeing the guy with the visor and whatever.
Yeah, that if they had like had a conversation or something, then I felt like that would have gone too far.
Which, and we know, I think even from the show, I think somebody mentions that Geordi and Will like graduated, or they were at least at the academy at the same time. So like that kind of made sense. But yeah, I agree about Janeway. She, with those scenes at the end, like, I mean, like the way it was set up, like, you know, with Kyle Riker asking, I don't know why I always have to use his full name, Kyle Riker. When Kyle asks, Admiral Paris, you know, do you have anybody that you trust implicitly and blah, blah, blah. And he's like, yeah, I got just the person. I mean, honestly, I had no idea. I didn't know where it was going. I was just reading along, whatever. And I know in the show Voyager, Janeway had talked to Tom, I think, about the fact that she worked, you know, she knew his father and she worked with him or whatever. But I almost feel like, instead of having her, like, if they wanted to have Janeway, they should have had her father, because I think he was an admiral also.
Like, that would have been interesting.
I would have liked that. Yeah. But I mean, here, like you said, like, she was a little bit shoved in there. And even some of the comments at the very end, like, after, you know, like when Paris is like kind of patting her on the back saying, you did a really good job, you know, someday, you know,
or maybe someday you'll have a starship too.
Maybe said, and maybe you can, maybe my son can, you know, whatever. And it was just like, oh, come on. Like, okay, that was, I agree. That was a little bit much, you know, like, fine, have her in there, but even still, it was like, of all of the cameos, like they could have done. I mean,
like, you know you've messed up a cameo when I'm against using it, because I ordinarily especially Voyager is my favorite crew. So sure. When I'm reading any book, I'm like always excited to see a Voyager character pop up. I'm like, oh, Tuvok's in this book, yes, or oh, ooh, we sing B'Elanna, or like. I always like that, but this time I was just like, oh, come on, this was not it.
Tuvok was actually noticeably missing from this book, since we know he was at some point, like he was in Starfleet during Sulu's time.
He's fairly old.
But then he, after he was on the Excelsior, I think he retired from Starfleet, but then went back to teach for a while. And I think it was Janeway that convinced him to come back to Starfleet, I think.
To be honest, if that had been Tuvok in the Janeway role there at the end, if he was the one that was poring over this data, I think it would have worked better, because Tuvok is this naturally analytical character, and he's very good at like noticing things like that. So I think that would have worked better, and it would have felt less shoehorned.
Yeah.
if he had served that role there.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Oh, well.
Yeah. If we go back and rewrite it at some point, we'll
exactly
we'll recast.
We'll do it. We'll do the like they have like editor's cut or assembly cut. This will be the literary treks cut.
Exactly. Perfect.
Nobody would pay to read it, but it would be fun.
Yes. Well, anything else that we didn't cover that you wanted to mention? I remember, I think before we started recording, you mentioned that this was especially good for how to do Star Trek books, I think.
Yes. Thank you for reminding me. So I've noticed that there is a certain type of Star Trek story I really enjoy. And I really enjoy thrillers in Star Trek. I mean, stories like, you know, Takedown is one of my favorite Star Trek books. And even the Prey trilogy has some classic Trek elements in it, but it also has that thriller aspect. And I've found that those types of thriller books tend to resonate with me more than the books that are more purely exploratory based, or the books that are purely episode design, like the ones that are meant to be like the traditional episodes. Mm-hmm. And this one had, I think, the perfect balance. It was a political thriller that had other elements like the Academy in it. And then at the end, it did feel like it had traditional Star Trek. So it never felt like I was reading something with Star Trek slapped on it. Instead, it felt like a perfect Star Trek story that had new elements and felt fresh at the same time. And so this kind of balance of the thriller with the traditional Star Trek and maybe add something else, like a little bit of something else in there, in this case, the Academy love triangle stuff, that I found really works for me in the writing.
That's a good point. I hadn't really thought about that, but yeah, I think, yeah, there's been numerous books that feel like somebody wrote a book and they're like, oh, I need to write a Star Trek book. Let me just replace the character names or the setting or whatever. And it never seems to work, but this one definitely does have a lot of elements that just feel like Star Trek kind of, I mean, even the whole, like there's a lot of father son dynamics throughout this, which is something we see a lot in Star Trek. I mean, you know, between Wesley Crusher's kind of lack of a father, I guess, and then you got Ben and Jake Sisko, which we actually get to see in this book. But I mean,
the Worf and Alexander.
Yep, the worst father of the year. yeah, I mean, you know, and that's actually peppered throughout this entire book, from like, you know, Kyle and Will to, I mean, even Owen and Tom Paris a little bit, and to the kind of villain of the story. And then just kind of, you know, the, as they say on Mission Log, the morals, meanings, and messages, like we get that out of this book, like Will Riker deciding to not help his friend cheat, even though it's like it's no skin off his teeth. Like, and even says like he graduated just like the rest of us, you know, like, it's Dennis's career to lose, you know, but he still says, no, I can't, that's too far. I can't do that. But, yeah, I think having these thrillers and these mysteries is really fun. And yeah, Takedown is one that I've recently read and just had a blast reading it, 'cause it was so good. And yeah, like those types of stories, and we're so used to mysteries, I feel like, anymore too, with like a lot of the new shows. And I mean, just in our day and age, I feel like a good mystery is what hooks people. A couple of years ago, probably now, Matthew and I read Enterprise, The First Adventure, which was kind of the first big Star Trek book, I guess, the first giant novel, first unnumbered one or whatever.
I think I have that one somewhere on my shelves.
Yeah. And I don't remember exactly how I felt about it, but it was kind of one of those stories that was like, from what I recall, like there was no mystery to it. It was just like they were escorting a like a circus, or like a, you know, some kind of acting troupe or whatever, from one planet to another. And maybe there was probably some murder or something that happened or whatever, but like there was no real threats or anything to the ship, like, you know. And I do like it in this. I mean, even in this book here, it was like, oh god, is something gonna happen to Kyle? Which, no, because we see him later. But like, right, you know, if it kind of gets you to forget some of that and like really feel a sense of foreboding or whatever for the characters, like, then I feel like they're very successful. Well, what did you end up rating this one? It sounds like we've or is there any other thing other than the Janeway, I guess, that you did not like about it?
No, I think we covered like the stuff I didn't particularly love about the book. So I gave a really high rating. If we're talking about out of five, I would give it a 4.5 out of 5. Like, I really enjoyed it. This was a top book of the year so far for me, for Star Trek at least. So I had a blast with it. This is my type of Star Trek book that I like.
Nice. Yeah, I gave it a 4 out of 5. It was just, I don't know what else to say about that either. Just that, yeah, like it is a great story. The author, you know, they understood the assignment basically, mm-hmm. and I feel like he got it. Like,
he has two other Star Trek books to his name. I had seen the cover for both of them, but like haven't heard people talk about them before. But after reading this, I'm like, you know what? If we eventually choose that as a future book, I'm not opposed to it.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking the same thing. Like, I'll look up what other ones he's written and maybe we'll find one of those to read because I'm a fan.
Yeah. So we are wrapping up The Lost Era, finally. Next month, we have one final Lost Era book to read, and that is going to be Catalyst of Sorrows, 2360, by Margaret Wander... Is it Bonanno? Banana? I don't know.
I have no idea.
Bonanno. Yeah. Catalyst of Sorrows. This is the story that I believe is focusing on... Uhura, is that right?
Yeah, I think Uhura, and I feel like Sisko maybe too.
I think Sisko,
I don't have it in front of me, Uhura, but yeah, Sisko. It's...
So, I'm excited to finish up this era and see where we go beyond this. We kind of have a roadmap, kind of, for the next few months. I'm excited to reveal that as we go along. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Literary Treks. Again, we talked at the beginning, find all the places that you can connect with us online, like the Babel Conference or Trek FM on X and Instagram. And thank you so much for listening. And until next time, live long
and read on.
What do you call that, light reading?
To each his own, number one.